You're listening to Return to the Source here at 90.9 FM. Of course, music by trombonist Steve Davis, and it's from his new release on Smoke Sessions Records called Correlations. And you're listening to his composition, one called Subtlety. And of course, all of that is in preparation for, of course, our interview tonight with Steve Davis. He's a trombonist, composer, and educator. He grew up in Binghamton, New York, and he went on to study jazz with Jackie McLean at the Hartz School, and of course also the Jackie McLean Institute at the University of Hartford, I should mention. And of course also he joined the Jazz Messengers in December of 1989. He's been on the faculty of the Hartz School since 1991, and of course he's also continues teaching at Jackie McLean's Artist Collective in Hartford. He's gained further international recognition as part of McLean's Sextet from 1992 through 1997 and Chick Corea's group Origin from 1997 through 2001. He's also been a member of the acclaimed Sextet One for All since its inception in 1996. And in addition to the Hartz School and the Artist Collective, Davis's other educational endeavors include Jamie Abersall's Summer Jazz Workshops, the Jazz in July program at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst, and the Stanford Jazz Workshop, just to name several. In addition to his experiences with Art Blakey, Jackie McLean, and Chick Corea, he's also worked with Larry Willis, Freddie Hubbard, Slide Hampton, Jimmy Heath, Ron Carter, Horace Silver, the Lincoln Center Jazz Orchestra, Benny Golson, Cedar Walton, and Christian McBride. His most recent recordings have been on Smoke Sessions Records, including his new release, Correlations, which feature his Correlations Sextet. We're going to talk about that and much, much more. And Steve Davis, welcome to Return to the Source and WJAB.
Oh, Ted, it's very humbling to hear you, my resume like that, and for your listeners, and it's just really a pleasure to join you this evening. Thank you.
All right, Steve, let's talk about some of your early influences. Now, in the late 70s, I went to school in Ithaca, New York, and I would often I would often take the bus down to New York City, and of course the bus would always make a stop in Binghamton, and I would always be wondering what was happening in Binghamton. So tell me, what was happening in Binghamton? Was that where you first became interested in jazz, man?
Yeah, wow, that's a great story. Yes, it is. My father, who was a newspaper journalist for about three decades, and he does some kind of health, public health consulting now in upstate New York, but he's really a newspaper man and an avid jazz and blues record collector and fan. And in fact, I bought my copy of Blue Train in Ithaca, New York. When I was in the 10th grade, I think he drove me up to, there was a great record store up there at the time in the early 80s, and he said, oh, you got to have this one. And I've been listening to it ever since.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you know, he was listening to a lot of Blue Note records, Lee Morgan, The Sidewinder, Art Blakey and the Jazz Messengers, Horace Silver, stuff like that. And I, when I was about 14, my ears kind of woke up to jazz music, and
Okay, now, and I know in Binghamton, right, there were other musicians like Chris Jensen, Dina DeRose, and several others. So I guess there was a jazz community there, right?
Oh, yeah, very much so. You know, starting in the public schools, we had some great teachers who were very supportive. Al Thompson, Tom Mann, Don Mayola, who was my West Junior High School stage band conductor, and he would let us solo our brains out, man. He really encouraged it. And then at the university level, Al Hom ran for a very long time a wonderful jazz program there, and had summer workshops and all kinds of concert series. And there was a pianist in town, he's still there, named Doug Beardsley, who he was kind of like our real guru. Unofficially, but we would go hear him every Tuesday night at a little club called the Music Box, and he would let us sit in when we were in high school, and you know, ninth grade, 10th grade, and we were all hungry and trying to play. And then my house, my parents' house, was jam session headquarters, man. you know, meet. And I had music in the family. My Nana, my mother's mother, my grandmother, played stride piano.
Okay.
And she didn't read a note. She never learned to read music her whole life. She died at 69 years old in 1986. And, I mean, we'd go visit her in Connecticut, and she'd be playing Honeysuckle Rose and Them Dare Eyes and Undecided and Embraceable You and, you know, all the great American songbook tunes,
yeah.
Boogie Woogie style piano. And I just thought, everybody's grandmother does that, you know? And I began to realize nobody's grandmother hardly did that. And then my grandsir, my grandfather on my dad's side up in Massachusetts, near Boston, he was also a newspaper journalist, but an avid jazz fan his whole life. Loved Duke Ellington, Louis Armstrong, you know, played the trumpet as a hobby. And he'd belt out When the Saints Go Marching In and stuff like that. And so I guess it was just kind of in the atmosphere.
Well, you know, Steve,
one other great thing. Slam Stewart, the great bassist.
Yeah, yeah.
The Slam Stewart lived in Binghamton the last 20 years of his life. And I'm not sure if he was there in the early 70s yet when you were rolling through there. He might have just moved there around that time. And his house was at 80 Chestnut Street. It was kind of pretty much like across the park behind right field of the Little League field I grew up playing on. And we just knew about this cool slam jazz guy. When I was playing Little League baseball, I had no idea that this was the man that played with Lester Young and Art Tatum and Charlie Parker.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Well, you know, Steve, the more I talk, you know, with musicians, it's very interesting that in every town, there's you know, we tend to think of New York City and the big cities as the only place where people are playing jazz, but in every town there's somebody who's like the mentor.
Yeah.
Okay.
Very much so. And you know, I'm sure down in Arkansas, you know, there's all kinds of history. Going way back, where there's, you know, you could go past some old hotel or restaurant or bar and say, oh man, so and so used to play here in the 30s or the 50s.
Well, you know, I'm in Alabama, not Arkansas.
Alabama, I'm sorry.
I know to northerners there's no difference, but I'm...
No, there's a big difference. Yeah, there's a big difference. But, you're in...
Huntsville, Alabama.
Huntsville, Alabama.
Yeah.
Forgive me.
Yeah,
really,
it's okay, man.
Listeners, please forgive me. That'd be like in Rhode Island and Connecticut. You know. But yeah, in Alabama, of course. I mean, there's so much musical history and social history. And but you're right. This is true everywhere I've been, all over the country over the years, and certainly all over the world. I mean, they're great players playing this music everywhere now.
Well, you know, to follow that up, in fact, the school that I teach at and the campus where the radio station is on, Sun Ra attended college here for a couple of years, man.
Really?
Yeah, Sun Ra.
Right in Huntsville, Alabama.
Right here in Huntsville, Alabama. Yeah, because he's from Alabama. I think he's from Birmingham.
From Birmingham, okay. I mean, I always associate him with Chicago, but, you know, that's part of the great migration.
Yeah.
North to Chicago and Detroit.
And of course, you know, Nat King Cole was from Montgomery, and, of course, he went to Chicago. And so, yeah, there are a lot of great musicians from Alabama. But tell me, who were some of your biggest influences on the trombone, man?
When I first got excited about jazz music, I maybe just started playing the trombone, and it wasn't because of the trombone at all.
Okay.
I just loved the feel of the music. I always loved the rhythm section, the bass, like I said, my grandmother playing the piano and the drums and trumpet, you know, whatever it was. But then when I heard J.J. Johnson on Nutville and Cape Verdean Blues with Horace Silver.
Yeah.
And then started hearing him on many recordings. And then shortly after that, Curtis Fuller with the Messengers and the hundreds of records that he made over his career. Those two really like they spoiled me for life, you
yeah.
know?
Yeah.
And then Slide Hampton is a huge influence. And but, you know, early on I did listen to Trum Young with Louis Armstrong.
Yeah.
And I always loved that, too. And, you know, now, over the years, man, I'm listening to everybody. Jack Teagarden, Dickie Wells.
Yeah, okay.
You know, I mean, going back, actually, and just appreciating how many great players who invented this music, and there have been, and then right on up to guys like my colleague Michael Dees, who
oh yeah, I like him,
up in Michigan, who yeah, it was, you know, he always cites me as a big influence. I think I got him by about 15 years, but you know, he's one of the masters out here today, and people like Andre Hayward, who lives down in Texas where he's from originally, and Vincent Gardner, and
yeah.
David Gibson, who's in New York, and James Burton, who's a former student of mine, a wonderful trombone player with the Black Art Collective. And he and Mike Dees and I play in the Christian McBride Big Band
yeah.
section for the last decade. So, you know, I could go on and on. There's just so many great players.
Well, you know, it's interesting you mentioned, of course, J.J. and Curtis Fuller, because I talked with Steve Turay here on the show before, and of course he mentioned those same individuals as, you know, big influence, especially JJ. I guess you can't play the trombone without going through JJ, but
yeah, I mean, he's kind of like our Charlie Parker.
Yeah,
you know, he really changed the game, and yeah, Steve is another person who is about 20 years my senior. And I vividly recall being in college and first hearing him playing with Woody Shaw.
Oh, yeah. Just, yeah.
Wow. You know, so he's one of our heroes and greats. And Grayson Moncourt.
Oh, yeah.
Julian Priester are two others that I met and heard early on. And I just love, in each of their cases, I love their sound. And Jackie McLean put it this way about Grayson, that he had the nerve to just stick some sounds out there, you know, like Miles. And you know, I asked J-Mac one time, what was it about Grayson Moncourt and those great Blue Note records they made in the 60s?
Yeah, One Step Beyond.
One Step Beyond and Destination Out. And
yeah.
I said, what was it about Grayson? He just said, his nerve. I thought, wow, that's a great answer. And, and it's composing, too.
Yeah, okay. Well, and once again, I'm talking with Steve Davis. And Steve, tell us, how did you end up at the Hart School in the University of Hartford in Connecticut? How did you end up there, man?
Well, you know, it's only about 4 hours. Hartford is about 4 hours from Binghamton. And I was aware that Hart, H-A-R-T-T, you know, was a very, you know, very fine, prestigious music school, and that Jackie McLean had been teaching there for some time, and I had records that he was on, and you know, that was very exciting, just to meet him. And I actually auditioned at Ithaca College
with
Steve Brown, and Rutgers and New England Conservatory, and you know, there were a handful of schools in the Northeast at that time that had jazz departments at all.
Yeah.
It was still kind of relatively new in the early mid 80s. So, but when I met Jackie McLean in person, oh man, game over. And he heard me, you know, I auditioned in a room just for him and me and my trombone, and I was 17 years old, little corny white kid, you know, from Binghamton, kind of scared. And he said, okay. He said, play me something, son. So I played Summertime. And I played a little turnaround, you know. He said, ha ha. And he kind of plunked it out on the piano, what I played. And then he started playing these chords that sounded like A Night in Tunisia on steroids. And it was so jagged and hip. And it was something he was working on. He said, let me see what you can do with this. And he started playing, and so I played something that made sense. Be-do, be-do, do-do, do. And he did it again. He laughed, and he sang it. He said, he used an expletive, but not a terrible one. But he said, "You got all the shit happening, son. Where's your mother?" You know. And so we went upstairs and met my grandmother and my mom, and he charmed the socks off my mother, but in a very genuine way. And my mom just said, "Oh, Professor McLean, really? He seems like he really cares about his students." Mm-hmm. You know, it's funny. I wound up going back there to teach at such a young age, and then joined Jackie's band after 3 years in New York, and kind of did it from there ever since.
Yeah. Okay.
As you know, kind of following Jackie McLean's footsteps as a educator and mentor, and also a full time musician, and you know, being in New York as much as you need to be, and traveling.
Yeah. Well, you know,
go ahead. No, please.
You know, I was going to say, you know, Jackie McLean had a distinctive sound, right? How would you characterize his sound, man?
That's a great question. He had kind of all of everything in his sound. The way I would put it is totally unique. You hear one note, you know it's...
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Fire, intensity, urgency, conviction. There's just something so compelling going on there in his time, his beat, his sound, and the notes he chose and the harmonic devices. But with all that, you know, he was super hip, not satisfied with the status quo. He was always reaching for something different. But at the same time, he was a dyed-in-the-wool bebopper.
Oh, yeah.
He learned to play from Bud Powell and Bird and Miles, you know, back in the late 40s, early 50s. And he loved pretty melodies, and he was very melodic and had a lot of super hip blues. And it seems like yesterday he used to tell me that he felt that I had a similar concept to him, which would make me, you know, 30 years ago or 25 years ago, I would kind of giggle at that and think, well, it's because I've learned to play, you know, being around you, you know. But he said, nah, you already came with something from your upbringing. And he said, you know, you got a slick blues concept. And I thought, wow, that's a supreme compliment. But at the same time, he could really make you feel very special, and you know, he was pumping us up, and he was giving us the tradition, and all that is so beautiful. But at the same time, man, one time I was 18, he took us to a school in Torrington, Connecticut. We played an assembly, we had our suits and ties, and it was like my first time ever playing with him, quintet. So he said, "Do you know Solar by Miles?" I said, "Yeah, I thought I did." So we played it. And I kept coming in on the beat, like ba 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 da ba, and it's off the beat, it's boom ba da ba da da. But I knew something wasn't lining up, but you know, it was okay. And so afterwards, the audience is clapping, and he's got us all up, you know, standing there, and you're kind of feeling, wow, man, this is so cool. Right at that point, he's got a smile on his face. He kind of leans over and tugs at my wrist, my sleeve, and he whispers in my ear, right on the stage, he says, "I don't know where you learned Solar, some Binghamton kind of way. I learned it from Miles. Can you stay off of one and phrase with me next time? Can you do that, son?" I said, "Okay, Jamie. Okay, take a bow. You know." that's jazz education.
That's right. That's right. Now, I mentioned, of course, that you joined Art Blakey and the Jazz Messengers in 1989. In fact, you were part of, I guess, the last group of messengers with Brian Lynch, Javon Jackson, Jeff Keyser, and others. And actually, on my show, I've talked with a number of messengers. I won't say ex-messengers, because I guess once you're a messenger, you're always a messenger. I've talked with Billy Harper, Cedar Walton, Horace Silver, Benny Green, Javon Jackson, and others. What did the messenger experience mean to you and your development, man?
Boy, that's quite a roster of people that you've connected with. That's wonderful. Well, I was the last one
Yeah.
Not just the last trombone, but I replaced Frank Lacy, and then I had my 9 months, eight or nine months there, and that was it. And Art passed away, so I'm probably one of the least qualified, you know, of everyone you named. But I didn't have that time with Art, and my first trip off the East Coast really was with him, and my first record date was his last record date.
Yeah.
And you know, oh man, Art Blakey, wow. I can tell one funny story. We went to Los Angeles, and the first night we're at Catalina's Bar and Grill in Hollywood, and Freddie Hubbard's sitting right at the front table because he lived there. It was 1990, so he's hanging out, and he's right in front of me, and Art Blakey's right behind me. And I'm thinking, how did my little Binghamton rear end wind up here, you know? And, you know, so there, you know, there you are. So, you know, I was playing where I think we played a Kenny Dorham tune, Miner's Holiday. And I heard Art playing some stuff back there, but, you know, really firing things up. And then I heard him kind of saying something and yelling something. So I thought, oh, man, I'll take another chorus. You know, and I played another one, and then I heard clear as day, "Get out that hole." Now, Doug, that's not good. I'm like, get out that hole. You know, that makes me think about getting out of the hole when I said Arkansas instead of Alabama. Because I know where you are. I just, you know, people aren't going to like that. So,
yeah.
So, you know, after the set, he took me aside, he put his arm around me right after we finished playing. He's not in front of everybody, he kind of pulled me aside and very directly said, "Hey, Steve." I said, "Yeah, Art." He puts his arm around me. He says, "You make your statement, you build to a climax, and you get the bleep out." He didn't say bleep. And then he said, "Simple, right?" I said, "Yeah, Art." He said, "We'll do it then." and then he went to the bar. And in fact, Javon Jackson was in that band, and Brian Lynch, and Javon and I teach together at the Hart School with Nat Reeves, the bassist, and Renee McLean, and Abraham Burton, and Eric McPherson, and Rick Jermison. We got a great program up there. So, yeah, I mean, now it's 30 years later, but what a great lesson, you know. That was.
So I guess that was the first time you had one of your compositions recorded, right? One for All?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and it was like the end of the second day of recording. I was the new guy. I didn't even think they'd use it. And it wound up being the title track of the record.
Yeah.
And what an honor. And then, you know, the band with Eric Alexander and Farnsworth and all the guys, we kind of took its name from that song five years later or so. But it wasn't my idea. It was kind of Farnsworth just goofing around. And,
okay.
No one really knew who was going to be the leader. So we just kind of made it a cooperative. And now that's 20 years ago.
Yeah.
Plus, so.
Time flies, doesn't it, man?
It sure can.
Yeah. Now, after of course, you spent 5 years with Jackie McLean's Sextet, and of course, you're on several of the recordings, Rhythm of the Earth, Fire and Love with the Mac Band, and then you joined Chick Corea's group Origin, and where you spent about 4 years. What did you get from that experience with Chick, man?
Wow, yeah, just amazing music. I think we went everywhere in the world twice in those few years, and you know, Chick, and I've worked with Chick since on some projects periodically, and actually I'm gonna tour with him this summer in Europe for 5 weeks.
Okay.
With the My Spanish Heart band. So your listeners can look for that record. It's called The Antidote, and it should be coming out pretty soon. So you know, and it's very heavy on flamenco music,
mm-hmm.
not so much straight ahead swinging music, but still nonetheless incredible music. And I always learn a great deal being in Chick's atmosphere, and he always encouraged us to really communicate, to really play with the intention of trying to connect, you know, and not just get up there and run your stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, he just brings out the magic in you. He brings out the spontaneity, and he plays so much ridiculous amounts of piano that, you know, it just kind of compels you to come up with something special. You're not going to outdo him or anything like that. Certainly not playing the slide trombone. But he always calls me Davissimo, the melody man. Or lately he said, you're the poet laureate of the trombone. You know, I mean, it kind of makes me chuckle, but he kind of makes me feel confident to just play what I play. And it's like that playing with Larry Willis, too. I have had a long association with him, and yeah, he's one of my dearest friends. And
great piano player, yeah.
Oh, man. Yeah, and composer and all of it. And, you know, so if you have Chick or Larry or someone like that, David Hazeltine and Montreal, someone like that comping, Xavier Davis, who's in the Correlation group.
Oh, yeah,
yeah. Fabulous accompanist. And if you fill up all the space as a horn player, why would you do that? I mean, you say something, see what you get back, and then it's almost like the less you play, the more of a genius you sound like. You
know? Well, let's talk about One For All for a minute. And you mentioned David Hazeltine, who I interviewed about 3 months ago here on the show, and Eric Alexander I've interviewed here. What do you see the group One For All, and I asked Hazeltine this question too, do you see the group One For All sort of carrying forth the messenger tradition, or is that too narrow a perception? Hazeltine thought it was a little too narrow, but what do you think about that, man?
Yeah, I would say that's, I mean certainly it's a compliment, you know. It's almost akin to, over the years, that people said, man, you remind me of Curtis Fuller. Man, you remind me of J.J. Johnson. I say, thank you.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, wow, you know. But with that said, I'm fairly confident I have my own sound these days, and have for some time. And same goes true with One For All. I think we never set out to be a Messengers clone kind of band.
Yeah.
And actually never did. We hardly touched any of that repertoire at all.
Yeah, that's right.
And so finally there was the Japanese label we did several recordings for, Venus. And about the third one we did for them, they said, would you do an Art Blakey tribute? And Hazel really did not want to do it.
Yeah, okay.
But then we all kind of said, hey, we love that music. Like, why not, you know? And so we recorded some Benny Golson and Curtis Fuller and Cedar and, you know,
yeah,
Freddie Hubbard. I can't remember. So, I mean, I think the connection's there, but I think the One For All band just kind of has its own vibe and its own sound. And I always enjoy very much being a member of that band and playing with that band. We're going to play Smoke in New York in a couple months, the middle of June.
Are you guys doing a live recording there? Or?
I don't know if that's happening
this
time, but we'll be due to make another record soon, so I hope so.
Okay. And will it possibly be on Smoke Sessions? I like the product that Smoke Sessions puts out. I mean, it's straight ahead. Some might say it's, you know, too much straight ahead, but I love the music on Smoke Sessions, man.
Thank you, and I do too. And you know, Paul Stash and Damon Smith do a great job at the label, just and of course with the club, Paul and everybody, all the staff and all the people. His longtime partner Frank Christopher, who's no longer involved, but he had a lot to do with the club's success and the label's success. And it's a great situation to be a part of on a lot of levels. And I like that Paul is giving priority to recording the masters.
Yeah.
Louis Hayes and Harold Mayburn and George Coleman and Jimmy Cobb.
Yeah.
People that, you know, it's very important to continue to document them as long as they're feeling good and playing on a high level, the highest level. And then, you know, he's recorded people like myself and some of my peers. And I think fairly soon he's probably going to start recording some of the younger up-and-coming musicians too.
Okay.
And it's all beautiful.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know what you're going to get with Smoke Sessions. I mean, it's going to be straight ahead, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I like that. Now, let's talk about your new recording. And once again, I'm talking with Steve Davis, trombonist, composer, and educator. Your new recording is on Smoke Sessions. It's called Correlations, and it features your Correlations Sextet. Tell me a little bit about the band. A number of them are former students, right?
Yeah. Over a pretty lengthy period of time, too, Jonathan Barber, the drummer, and Josh Bruno, the trumpet player, are about 30.
Okay.
And then Desron Douglas and Wayne Escoffrey is a little older than Desron, and they're late 30s, 40-ish. And then Xavier Davis teaches at Michigan State University up in East Lansing, where I just spent a week last week.
Okay.
They have a fabulous jazz studies program there.
That's why we couldn't do the interview last week, because you were doing a residency, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Good memory, yeah. And, yeah, so Rodney Whitaker, the bassist, has been chairing that department for years, and I can't say enough. And Mike Dees teaches there in Zays, and ATN Charles. The drummer, Randy Gillespie, Uncle G. So, yeah, I mean, I started to digress, but what a great program.
Yeah.
Great jazz community up there. I can't say enough about it. So Xavier is kind of the only non-Hartford J-Mac lineage guy.
Okay.
But Zave and I have played together, a good 20 years now. We worked a lot with the New Jazz Composers Octet.
Okay.
Freddie Hubbard.
Yeah.
And Christian McBride's big band with Steve Ture together. And then he and Wayne Escoffrey have the group I mentioned earlier, the Black Art Collective with Jeremy Pelt and James Burton.
Yeah, okay.
Jonathan Blake and Vicente Archer on bass. So, yeah, I mean, so he's definitely in the family. But, you know, there's so many musicians that come out of the Jackie McLean school, if you will, over the last 20, 30 years, that it's easy to just, you know, find great musicians that you have a simpatico with.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In fact, I like Xavier's latest recording, Rise Up Detroit. I mean, I like that a lot. Now, as on many of your recordings, of course, Correlations features a number of your compositions. And we'll talk about some of those in a minute. But I really like to ask you about the tunes that weren't composed by you. I'm always fascinated by the tunes that, you know, musicians pick to be on their recordings. And this time, you know, some of these, they were all some of my favorite tunes. One of them I played at the very beginning of the show, Think on Me. Tell me why you picked that tune, man.
Oh, wow. That's George Cable.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's one of those songs that I learned in my early 20s, and it wasn't often played, but it's being played and covered more often.
Yeah, it is.
Because it's a masterpiece.
Yeah, it is.
And Mr. Cable's another Smoke Sessions artist, is alive and well, and he's with us, and he's playing so great. And the several times I've been around him and had a chance to play with him and just sit and talk, he's just a gem of a human being.
Yeah.
And, you know, I wanted to honor him now.
Okay.
And you know, the tune is just so playable. And then we did something a little different with the intro and all, and I tried to voice it a certain way just so it had something fresh to it. But the tune is always going to be fresh.
Well, and I was going to say, you know, the first time I heard the tune, in fact, was on Woody Shaw's recording, Blackstone Legacy. You know, and I've loved that tune ever since then. But and I talked with George Cables here on the show maybe about a couple of years ago, and like you said, he was just a beautiful guy, man.
Oh man, yes, absolutely.
Understand, I mean, health wise, he was having a little problem. Is he okay now?
Yeah, he's been through some health stuff, but he's performing, and I saw him at the Roy Hargrove tribute a couple months ago, and He looked great. Yeah, sounded great. Just beautiful.
Okay. Now tell me why you chose Horace Silver's Peace. Now, you know, I always liked that tune. Tell me why you chose that one, man.
Yeah. Well, I always liked that tune too, like you, Doug. But it was easy. You know, Wayne. And Wayne knew Junior Cook's part cold. I know it too, but you know, so does Wayne. And so I thought, wow, Josh and Wayne can just play literally what Blue Mitchell and Junior Cook played.
Yeah.
And then I can play it by myself. And you don't hear too many trombone players play that song by themselves. And although I'm sure they have, but I don't know any recordings per se off the top of my head. I'm sure there are some somewhere, but and it just seemed like an easy way to arrange it, and it's a beautiful song. But on a deeper level, just considering the last few years, the social political climate we've been thrust into is so. I mean, it would be the most hilarious stuff of all time were it not so scary, and hurting so many human lives.
Right. Right.
What this administration is doing now, and has been doing the last few years. So I felt like, we could use some peace.
Yeah, we can. And you know, and when I talked with Horace Silver, he said, you know, the group that with Blue Mitchell and Junior Cook was his favorite group. So, he said that was his favorite. But another tune you picked there, of course, was McCoy Tyner's Inner Glimpse. Tell me why you picked that one, man. I like any of McCoy's stuff.
What a titan. And yeah, kind of similar. I mean, he is such a hero for all of us, and still living. And we needed something to kind of blast off with, you know, in the mix. And we had something a little bit up tempo and just that we could really kind of let it fly. Rather than write something, I had plenty of originals already on the program. I thought, let's do that one. But with the sextet, it was kind of cool to come up with some different voicings and then do the intro sort of free in front again. And, you know, just put some touches on it to give it a little bit of a unique interpretation, but just kind of play the tune at the same time.
Well, you know, I understand McCoy was having some health issues. Have you seen him lately? Is he doing okay now?
I haven't, and I, you know, Wynton Marsalis called recently. I hadn't played with him in, probably 13 years or something, but to cover a couple dates, one of his trombonists couldn't make it, and I have a gig this weekend coming up with Carl Allen out in Salt Lake City and Ralph Moore, and I'm very honored to be involved with that band and Carl's great projects. And wouldn't you know it, about 3 days later, I get a call to do the concerts at Jazz at Lincoln Center with McCoy Tyner and Charles McPherson. And I've never played with McCoy.
Yeah.
Almost about three different times. Can't win them all. So, that's one for the memoirs.
All right.
Now that's a good problem to have, right?
The final tune that I want to ask you about, of course, is Thad Jones, A Child Is Born. Now, Thad, I think, is one of the great jazz composers, and I don't think maybe he gets enough, you know, recognition for that, but why did you choose A Child Is Born?
That's a good one, too. I love kids, and I've got three from my first marriage, and they're all beautiful and driving. My oldest, my son Tony, is 24, and he's one of us. He's bebopping.
Okay.
He plays the guitar, and he's really good. And I never pushed him into it at all, and neither did his mother or anyone else. He just kind of came for it. And my daughter's musical, Angie, and she's going to attend Hart.
Okay.
Music education.
What does she play?
Well, she sings and plays a little piano.
Okay.
And, yeah, and then my youngest, Nikki, he plays saxophone, and he's in seventh grade and 12 years old. And they're all really musical. Tony went to Hart. Now he's at City College with Steve Wilson in New York.
Okay.
And, gigging around. In fact, Mike LaDon has been hiring him to sub for Peter Bernstein.
Okay, wow.
The Ruger Quartet. And so it just really cracked me up that I heard through the grapevine he was going to play with Farnsworth and Alexander and Mike LaDon. And I said, well, good luck, kid. They've been beating me up for 20 years. But of course, no, I'm just kidding. But they all like him. So, you know, he's forging his way, and he and I like to play together.
Okay.
And also my wife, Abana Coomson Davis, she's a wonderful vocalist, and I can't wait to record with her and Tony.
Okay. So that's how you say it. You say it, Abana, huh? Not Abina.
It's Abana.
Abana,
yeah,
okay. I've been saying Abina, man.
Oh.
Every time I play that tune, you know, Abana's Gaze, I've been saying Abina, so now I got it right, man.
Yeah, Abana is a Ghanaian name that means a woman or girl born on Tuesday.
Okay.
You know how, like, Kofi Annan, or I think that's a boy born on Friday, I think Kofi might be.
Uh-huh.
I never knew any of this until I met her
okay.
years back.
Okay.
And met her family. And she, you know, she was born in Hartford and raised, which is ironic, because I met her in New York. And she actually went to high school a year ahead of Jimmy Green.
Okay.
Saxophonist.
Yeah, who I like a lot too. Yeah, I like Jimmy Green.
Oh, man, yeah. Yeah, he's so special. So, yeah, but, I just love the song. Just like you, I think Thad Jones is one of the all-time great arrangers, composers, and it's such a beautiful tune, and it's in 3/4.
Yeah.
So, yeah, just something pretty to play.
Okay. Now on your new CD, you know, of course, most of the tunes are your compositions. One of them that I really like is Subtlety. Tell me a little bit about Subtlety. In fact, I played it before we just went on the air. Tell me a little bit about the tune, man.
Oh, wow. Well, yeah, you know, something about the chords and voicing them for the three, you know, horns, it felt like there's some nuance there. But then you got the bass line, which is kind of busy, but it's sort of low key at the same time. And I don't know, just something about the chords. Maybe there's some suspended fourth chords, and I've always written with the sus chords. I love them. So they're kind of pliable. You know, you can play them as dominants, or you can kind of play some more, I don't know what the right word is, just a little bit more obliquely over it, maybe. But then the real kicker is, you know, I had already named the song, and then Abana kept hearing it, and then she said one day, she said, "Bing, this song is called Subtlety. Da 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 da. This song is called Subtlety." And she put lyrics to the bass line, "Get out of here." But it fits. So, we have fun playing it.
Okay.
One thing I can say about the Correlations Band, I'm really trying to book the group. I'm working with a young lady in Amsterdam who does booking and management, and so we're looking at 2020, 2019, and 2020, because this summer I'm already committed with Chick, and I would be rather foolish to not do
yeah,
that. But
yeah.
You know, I'd like to push for this group and I want to play with my son and my wife, Avana, who's a really great singer, and she's never made a jazz record, and she's ready.
Okay.
And I think people are going to be very pleasantly surprised when they hear her sing and interpret standards and originals, and I think people will be happy to hear her. She sang a little up in Michigan last week.
Okay.
It was very, very well received. We had a ball together. So, you know, I'm just hoping to take this group, because whenever I lead a band, and in this case, as much as any band as I've ever had, it feels like our band.
Okay.
It's not my band. Yeah, okay, maybe I lead it, but it's got to feel like our band, and then it really thrives.
Okay.
And that's what's happening with the Correlations band, definitely.
And once again, I'm talking with trombonist, composer, educator Steve Davis. And Steve, as I mentioned to you, you know, you're one of my favorite musicians on the scene today, and not only do I like your playing, but I like your composing and the tunes that you write. And in addition to those that I already mentioned, you know, some of my favorites of yours include Optimism, Spirit Waltz, Evening Shades of Blue, Bright Side, you know, just to name a few of them.
Wow, Doug, thank you, man, thank you.
Do you set aside time just to compose, or do tunes just come to you, man?
I wish I could set aside time and just practice my horn. And usually you're just ripping and running, doing everything that you need to do in life just to make a living and be a good dad and a good teacher and good husband and a good friend and all that. So, but you know, I find that when something happens in your life or in society that inspires you or affects you in any kind of profound way, yeah, it kind of triggers some inspiration and creativity. Usually when I know I have a project coming up, it just kicks in a few weeks ahead of time or a month ahead of time.
Mm-hmm.
But then, you know, there are other ideas that just come to you, and then I might hum it into the voice memo just to kind of remember it. Or for years I was kind of a daredevil. I would just go to sleep and wake up, and my mantra was, if it was worth anything, it'll still be there in the morning. And that's, I don't know, I'm starting now, I'm a little older, I'll be 52 in April, and I'm thinking, yeah, maybe that's not a good idea.
You better start writing things down. So do you start with a melody, or do you start with a rhythm, or it can be either one?
Could be either. Oftentimes a rhythm, a rhythmic figure, or a bass line, or, like we were talking about earlier with subtlety, just chords.
Uh-huh.
You know, you just kind of fall in love with a certain chord progression, or it might even be just one chord, and you just love the feel of this texture of that chord, and then you think, what could grow out of this? What could blossom out of this? And you start hearing melodies and counter melodies or bass lines or rhythms, and then, you know, sometimes you don't think too much, you just kind of let it lead you where it's going to go. And something I share with students, and I'm sure this is hardly an original thought, but an expression I use is just be a good host to the notes, because they're just passing through, and they've been here hundreds of thousands of years, and they're going to be here hundreds of thousands of years. If you're lucky, you got 70, 80, maybe 90 years with them, if God willing. So that's pretty cool. But
I was talking with a musician friend of mine here in Huntsville, and it was after I had just watched a documentary on Quincy Jones. And
isn't that great, man?
Yeah, and you know, he talked about, you know, how he went to Paris to study orchestration, and the lady that he was studying with, you know, said, you know, there's 12 notes.
And Nadia Boulanger.
Yeah, and you know, it never dawned on me, and I mentioned this to my friend, it never dawned on me that there are only 12 notes, because musicians, especially jazz musicians, do so much with those 12 notes. that, you know, and then he explained to me, well, you know, there's harmonies and there's, you know, there's the chords and all the other things and the ways you can combine these notes. It's just amazing to me, man, that you can take 12 notes and do what you do.
Oh, Doug, man, that I thank you from all the musicians. Thank you. God, you've interviewed a lot of the greats, and I can tell you have a great rapport with everybody, and you're so knowledgeable. So that really means a lot to hear that coming from you. I know the folks in Huntsville and Alabama are just getting a treat every show you do and the music you're playing. Yeah, I mean,
I'm gonna have to pay you for that, man.
Oh, man. Shoot, Ray Charles can see that. He's blind in. You know, seriously, just talking to you for any period of time, it's like, wow, man, this is great. So, but you know, there's 12 tones, but then you've got several octaves.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Different ranges, you know, for different instruments. The piano is kind of like great grandma, which, you know, like seen it all. Done it all, like it's like the orchestra, but it's a drum. I love sitting at the piano.
Yeah.
And I'm self-taught. I never had any lessons or anything on the piano. You just observe as many pianists and listen, and the next thing you know, you kind of sit down and you start to know what to do. And,
yeah.
I spend a lot of time at the keyboard.
Okay.
Because all the information is there, and I love chords. But, you know, sometimes you need to break away from that and just think about the quality of different instruments unto themselves and melodies and rhythms and different combinations. So I would love to try some different things in the future. I may make just a trio record or have part of a record be just bass, drums, and me.
That would be interesting. Yeah. Yeah.
And, just, you know, and that one I'd call Room to Roam. but the problem is I love the damn piano too much and piano players, and I love other horns too much, and I love having my colleagues and fresh voices. We have a young lady at the Hart School named Sarah Hanahan. She's about to graduate, plays alto sax. 21 years old, man, she's going to set the world on fire.
Okay.
I mean, she is really serious, and she's going to be one of our next Jackie McLean Institute,
okay,
Hart School, jazz legacy, you know, superstars. And you know, that is so fun to just be all these years to be around young students. And the ones up at Michigan State last week,
yeah,
was Rodney Whitaker and Mike Dees and Davis. So, like, wow, man, just to watch the mentoring going on and then hear these young cats. There's a kid named Marcus Howell playing alto, who's, I think he's from Florida, from Tampa area. No, from Fort Lauderdale. I can't remember, but he's from Florida. But he's another one.
Yeah.
And a slew of trombone players, man. Dees has those guys. Professor Dees has them taking care of business.
Okay.
Man. So,
well,
it's great inspiration.
You know, you mentioned, you know, Ray Charles and you know, blind musicians, and I think I read, you know, that you had played with Stevie Wonder, and I noticed,
yeah,
that
I had my one glorious day with Stevie Wonder.
You know, and I noticed that more and more jazz musicians, you know, are playing his tunes. What is it about Stevie Wonder that makes his tunes, you know, so, you know, that, so, I guess, susceptible to you know, jazz treatments, man? Because I'm hearing more and more musicians, you know, playing his tunes.
Yeah, because they're great. They're earthy. The chord progressions are so hip.
Okay.
The melodies are so hip. His lyrics are beautiful. I mean, they're just masterpieces. Just like decades before him, Cole Porter's music, or Richard Rodgers.
Yeah.
Rodgers and... Well, Cole Porter played and composed and wrote his own lyrics. Whereas a lot of those guys back in the Tin Pan Alley days, you know, Richard Rodgers wrote the music and Oscar Hammerstein or Lorenz Hart wrote the lyrics.
Yeah.
Well, Stevie Wonder does everything.
Yeah.
He plays all the instruments, by the way, too.
Yeah.
And so, you know, to me, he's as heavy as anybody. in the American songbook catalog.
Yeah.
And we're just trying to catch up to his music.
Okay.
Pretty much.
Well, you have enough compositions, or maybe you do. I heard a lot of your compositions to maybe even publish a songbook. Have you done that yet, or have you thought about that?
Oh, man. Oh, that's a real compliment. Thank you. I have been more recently. Yeah, like it just kind of, it's just added up. And when I went to Michigan State, one of the young trombonists arranged a piece that I wrote called Grove's Groove.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that was on with the new Jazz Tet, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Originally, I recorded it with Roy Hargrove on one of my, it was my last crisscross date on called Update in 2005, and I knew Roy was going to be able to play three tunes on the session, so I just wrote it for him the week before. I got inspired, like I was saying, you know, and that's a classic example for me. And Roy came, learned it. Anthony Wansey, Nat Reeves, Joe Farnsworth, and Peter Bernstein, although he's not on that track, but he's on most of the record. And Roy loved it, played the heck out of it. Then Benny Golson heard it a few years later and called me up and asked me to join the new Jazz Tet.
Okay, yeah.
And said, I want to record your song, put it first on the record, and we'll open our concerts with it. And I thought, this is like the greatest dream I've ever had in my life. And when am I going to wake up, you know? And I'm thinking, we record your songs, Mr. Golson.
Yeah, yeah.
The other way around.
Yeah.
And but that happened, and then Mike Deese approached me a few years back and said, would I mind if he did a version? I said, are you kidding? You know, man, he's great. And now I go up there, and the Bebop Spartans big band, that's what they're called, they had this incredible arrangement on it, and we played it about five times last week, and it really got my wheels turning, that I gotta write and curate my own music heading into the future. And so you kind of read my mind.
Okay, okay. Well, I got one final question, Steve. I won't be talking for a while, and I know you know, I really appreciate you taking time out, man. But in terms of jazz education, what is your philosophy when it comes to jazz education? And I ask you that in the sense that it is a formal, structured kind of education that you get in these programs today. Is that all you need to be a good jazz musician, or is there something else that you need too?
You know, I certainly the technical aspects of music are important to study, the craft. My mentor, Jackie McLean, was very concerned with the history and the not just the musical history, the socio-political history.
Yeah.
And everything that informs, you know, what the music sounded like and is going to sound like, because of what's going on in society with human beings. And whenever I get asked to do some kind of trombone, jazz trombone clinic or master class, and there's, you know, 20 trombone players, you know, not just the young ones, it could be any ages, and they're sitting in a room with their horns, with desks, and there's no piano, and you know, it's 9 a.m, whatever. Not the most swinging scenario, but here we are nonetheless. And they're looking at you kind of like they want to take a bite out of your leg or something, you know. and I say that in jest.
Yeah.
You know, they're eager, and they're, okay, he's going to blow us away. He's going to show us all this, you know, incredible technique and all this. And I always kind of start with, what kind of person are you? You know, you're a human being. So, yeah, none of us is perfect, but you know, that's number one.
Yeah.
And then they kind of cock their head like sometimes, you know, like the dog looks at you. You know, and then number two, I kind of say, are you walking, talking music without the horn in your hand?
Yeah.
Can you just embody the music, sing it, clap it 24/7? Number three is we love the trombone. That's our voice. and there's the whole craft and technique of all that. But the piano's in there too, before you get to the trombone. Can you deliver the harmonic and rhythmic information and melodic information in your improvising and your composing when you're interpreting parts in the section, whatever it may be, ensemble playing, playing behind a singer, playing in a soul funk band, playing Latin jazz, big band. I mean, there are all these different settings, and you know, it's kind of like you got to have something to say, and you have to have a concept of the music as a whole before you're going to be a great virtuoso, iconic jazz trombone solo.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? It's not the technique first. You need as much technique as you need to play the music you need to play.
Yeah.
No more.
Well, are there the kind of opportunities for musicians today, you know, to play that you were exposed to? So, and I ask this of a lot of musicians, you know, when we're talking, you know, these schools are turning out, you know, all of these musicians, but are there places for them to, you know, really kind of learn how to play jazz? I mean, you know, like you said, you get the technical aspect, but, you know, being on the bandstand is a different thing.
Well, yeah, I mean, you raise a very valid point. It's funny because I speak with my colleagues and my peers more and more about the fact that whether we like it or not, cats my age are moving into that role, and we need to be the torchbearers and pass down this tradition now. And society's changed. Everybody has instant access, social media, all that. I think students, it's not their fault, but because this is all they know, they feel very entitled right off the bat.
Yeah.
And they just approach you, you know, real casually sometimes. And, you know, that's not how I was raised. And when I went to see Curtis Fuller or Art Farmer or somebody, man, it was, you had to go see them in New York or if they came through town, wherever you lived. And they usually did at some point, and then you had to have the nerve to go and introduce yourself and shake their hand. And they might give you their phone number or their address. You could write them a letter or, you know, and now it's, yo, hit me up on Instant Messenger. You know? But, you know, that's also really cool. It's a double-edged sword, like anything in life. And, you know, but with that said, I have met at our own program at the Hart School over the years, and places like Michigan State and many others, but definitely that one, where the students are so respectful, so talented, so serious, and it's all the right stuff, and they're gonna take this music forward. They are, and they're already doing it, and they're gonna be equipped to play darn near any type of music.
Okay.
So they're going to be able to make a living. It's not always going to be jazz, but there's a lot of great music to play.
Yeah.
And they'll take care of the jazz too.
So basically what you're trying to do is produce good musicians, and what they do with that is up to them, huh?
Yeah, and of course, if they can get through Round Midnight start to finish with if they can play a couple good choruses on Giant Steps, they can play Donna Lee and Con Alma by Dizzy Gillespie, and, you know, man, they're going to be equipped to handle damn near anything.
Okay.
And they'll be playing that music the rest of their lives, too. Hence, the tradition is alive and well.
All right. And once again, I've been talking with trombonist, composer, educator Steve Davis. And Steve, we're going to leave with another selection from your new recording, Correlations, and it's one of your compositions, Newbie. Tell me a little bit about that before we get out of here, man.
Oh, man. Wow. It started out so simple, I thought, is this even going to be a tune? Like, really? And then I started putting some changes under the melody, and my daughter, Angie, as she's been wont to do over the years, she came and sat next to me at the piano. She'd kind of heard it from the other room. It was kind of developing, and she said, "What's that, Dad? A newbie?" And I said, my instant thought was, well, I guess it's a tune because she thinks it is, and she also just named it.
Okay.
So,
okay.
So So that's the story of that one.
All right, then. And once again, Steve, thanks for taking time out of your schedule. I know we might have gone a little long, but I was, you know, just enjoying talking with you, man. So I do appreciate you taking time out.
Likewise, I'm running up to New Haven. There's a gig in about an hour.
Okay.
I'm going to make a little off the radar gig, but it's a great place called the Owl Shop Cigar Bar in New Haven, Connecticut, right near Yale.
Did I leave you enough time to get there, man?
Perfect.
Okay. All right.
It was a great conversation, and, you know, thank you to all your listeners in the Huntsville, Alabama area, and I hope they keep supporting you and jazz music.
Thank you very much. All right, take care, Steve.
Okay, Doug.
All right. Once again, that was Steve Davis, trombonist, composer, educator. Here's his tune called Newbie. And while you're listening to this tune, if you're my first caller at 256-372-5861, you can win a copy of the new CD by Steve Davis. We have a winner. Thank you very much. If you didn't get a chance to win this time, don't fret. There'll be other opportunities. In fact, tune in to it. Return to the Source this Sunday. You'll get another opportunity to win the CD by Steve Davis. Keep your dial here, 90.9 FM.
Hello, this is the maestro, Sean Patrick. Join me for Mellow Madness till midnight, 8 p.m. till 12 midnight, Tuesday through Saturday. We'll have fun, relaxation, and mellow music. We'll also have birthday tributes and oldies from the 50s through 2000. That's Mellow Madness till midnight, 8 p.m. till 12 midnight, Tuesday through Saturday on 90.9 FM, WJAB, and WJAB.org with the maestro, Sean Patrick.
This portion of our broadcast is made possible in part by James Bebe Morris of Woody Anderson Ford, providing new and pre-owned vehicles, sales, and leasing. Woody Anderson Ford is located at 2500 Jordan Lane in Huntsville and 1638 Hughes Road in Madison. For more information, James Bebe Morris at 256-990-4827.
Welcome to Return to the Source on WJAB, from the campus of Alabama A&M University, 90.9.
Welcome back to Return to the Source. I'm your host, Douglas Turner. We're going to play one more before we get out of here. It's another selection from the new recording by trombonist Steve Davis. We'll make this a Steve Davis evening tonight. And from a new recording called Correlations, it's another one of his compositions. This one's called Song for My Love.